You're listening to Talking Boat Stuff, the Waterways Podcast, where we celebrate everything in, on, and around the water. This episode was recorded live at the 2024 Toronto International Boat Show and is powered by America's Boating Channel. Now, here's your favorite captain of conversation, Stephen Bull.
Special guest, Alan Cross, the host of the ongoing History of New Music.
And well-renowned for my sailing capabilities.
Absolutely. Spoiler alert, question one.
No. I grew up on the prairies with rowboats and canoes. There was a river outside my grandparents' place called the Boggy River, which had an average depth of 4 feet and was filled with suckers and catfish. And that was really my experience growing up with boats.
Hey, that counts. I always say if you're floating, you're boating. So if it was floating in that 4 feet of water above the suckers and catfish, that's fine. But you've been out on the water, so you don't own a boat. You're not an avid boater. I think when I was we worked on a project together, ForgottenFestival.com, shameless plug. And I think when I texted you about something, you were out on a boat.
I was on a boat. I was on a 40-footer. Somewhere between the island of Moustique and the island of Bekwe in the Caribbean. We were doing a tour of the nearby islands. So, yeah, and I actually texted you back my compass heading.
Yeah, that was the best response. I think it even been about this as well. And I said, I don't know if you're a boater. And it was just a compass heading. That was solid. All right, so you're not here because of your boating expertise like some of our other guests. I want to talk to you about your world of expertise, which is music.
Right. Now, let's back up just a bit. I do like boats. I do spend an awful lot of time in the Caribbean. I spend a lot of time around boats. I'm occasionally on a boat, but I don't own one, nor do I understand anything about sailing or motorboating, anything. No.
Right.
But I do appreciate the culture, the community, and the scene around certain types of boating. I have friends that are members of the Royal Ontario Yacht Club. They sail. They have a boat. Royal Canadian Yacht Club. I am somebody that just sort of goes along for the ride.
See, that's the best type of... That's what I call the smart boaters. So you need to be boat adjacent.
That's right. Otherwise, you might as well just stay at home, tear up $100 bills in the shower. It's the same kind of effect.
Essentially. But it can be so much fun to tear up those $100 bills as an owner of multiple boats. I'm the opposite. I make bad decisions. I think we own 4 motorboats, an 11-foot little tender. We bought a 13-footer to run us back and forth to the Toronto Islands where we keep our 38-foot boat. And then for the show, I bought a 27-foot, 30-year-old powerboat that I took from Toronto to Montreal, then Montreal to Manhattan for a big journey, and then interviewed Neil deGrasse Tyson there about the science of boating. So that was cool, floating beside the Statue of Liberty. But, you know, maybe 4 boats is a bit much.
It is a bit much. I have 1 car.
Well, I have 1 Armada, so that...
you could actually launch your own Bay of Pigs.
Hopefully it'll go better for me, though, than them. Well, speaking of like the lifestyle and the culture, any culture and lifestyle and fun, there's going to be music involved in some form or fashion, whether it's primary driving the culture or just sort of a background soundtrack. And boating, there's a lot of live music and yacht rock. I mean, it's playing here at the Toronto Boat Show in the background. I think they're playing yacht rock radio. Let's talk about that. What is yacht rock?
Yacht rock is a type of very slick, high production values, uninspiring music that was big between about 1975 and 1984. While that music was around, and we're talking Christopher Cross, we're talking about Stevie Wonder, some Steely Dan, Jimmy Buffett would be part of this, certain Eagles songs would be part of it, certain Doobie Brothers songs, especially the Michael McDonald era, would be part of this. It's that really slick kind of soft rock that you would hear people listening to, the kind that had the jutting upper jaw at the yacht club, the Blue Bloods, that would talk about taking Muffy out on the sloop for the afternoon.
Oh,
on
yes,
Sunday.
Of course. Yes, yeah. Yes, yes.
So it was never called yacht rock when it was around. That was a term that came out later. There's some guy had a podcast about it, and he coined the term yacht rock because it just, and it's a good word because it evokes so many things, you know, sophistication and, you know, smooth grooves, nothing too, you know, that would get Muffy upset.
You don't want to rock the boat.
You don't want to rock the boat, exactly. So It is, I worked for a couple of years at a station that played an awful lot of yacht rock. You know, Whitney Houston would be there, Sergio Mendez, and you put Huey Lewis in the News, certain songs from them would figure. If, for example, you are the guy in American Psycho, Christian Bale's character, your favorite music was yacht rock.
Well, they, yeah, you know what?
That's probably not the kind of association a lot of people want with the music, but that's true. It's exactly right. What it is.
Yeah. So let's back up before we dive a little bit. So a lot of people listening to this will know who you are very well because you've been on the air broadcast, now podcast, Ongoing History of New Music. But tell me about the Coles Notes of your background and where you've gone and where you've been.
From the prairies, on a boat in the Boggy River with my Uncle Donnie, never had anything more than a 7.5 horse motor. I did have an aunt who was a commercial fisherman on Lake of the Woods. She had a 25-footer that she would fish pickerel out of the lake. My Uncle Sonny died when he was going in to get provisions one day, and his snowmobile fell through the ice, and I don't think we've ever found him. Okay, let's get back on board. So I Manitoba, worked in northwestern Ontario on Lake of the Woods, very much part of boating and fishing and hunting culture there.
Yep.
Then out to Brandon, Manitoba, which had no open water whatsoever. Back to Winnipeg, which had the Assiniboine and the Red Rivers. And then Lake Winnipeg to the north. Worked there for a couple of years at the Yacht Rock Station and then came to Toronto in 1986. And I've been at CFMY 102.1 The Edge more or less consistently ever since in some way or another. Boating... In recent years has been restricted to, okay, this is going to sound, okay, here's how I know about yacht rock. Because I have spent a lot of time, maybe I've got 20, 25 trips to St. Bart's, which is where all the rich and famous people go with their 350-foot yachts. And the port of St. Bart's is Gustavia, and berthing fees start at $2,500 a day. That's if you can get one. Otherwise, you have to be in the outer harbor where people like Jeff Bezos and back then Paul Allen and Roman Abramovich and all these other people would put their, 175-footer pluses out there. Octopus, which was Paul Allen's boat, had the two helicopter pads. And you could tell that when he was in town. Bezos was there this past holiday season. And I can't, he's 232, 250?
His new one?
His new one.
Yeah, something like it's, that. I should know, but it's
massive.
Insane.
It's just massive. We would go at a time of the year when none of the rich and famous people were there, so the prices were a lot more reasonable. And we had this one villa that we got for, I think, $3,500, $4,000 a week that overlooked the Caribbean. And kitty corner to us was Jimmy Buffett's house. And Jimmy Buffett's house was on the western side of the harbor in Gustavia, and it looked down over the cheapest restaurant on the place, an outdoor bar and burger joint called Le Select. Le Select is the origin of Cheeseburger in Paradise. And that's what he wrote it about. And when Jimmy Buffett died last year, we were in St. Bart's the last time in December. The whole place went into mourning because he had just built a brand new house. He Le Select has been there since 1950 something, and it was really quite sad. Again, I've kind of diverged. Right. This is a freewheeling thing, right?
Absolutely.
So I've kind of gone off.
Feel free to go on diverge. No, just like that. That's fascinating.
Yeah. So we have been throughout the Caribbean, various, back last March, we were in Bekwe, their port is Port Elizabeth. It's small, but, and none of the big yachts go there, but it's a smaller place for the kind of people who want to island hop starting in, let's say, Puerto Rico and make their way down through the Grenadines down to, I guess, ultimately Barbados. And you have these people, which I find absolutely, I'm so jealous of them because they have such a sense of being a boating person that they are had no trouble just picking up, moving everything onto a boat, family and all, and spend the time flitting from island to island to island without a care in the world. I am so jealous of their courage.
Yeah, actually, there's a guy that I worked with. He actually was the co-host with me for a few years when I was with Powerboat Television, which is no longer on the air. And he would talk about his dream. He and his wife were going to sell their house. They're going to buy a sailboat. They're going to sail down to the Caribbean and then eventually around the world. And I will admit, and I eat crow every time I bring them up, John and Sherry, I am sorry, I was wrong. I didn't think they were going to do it because that's a, you know, it's a big,
oh, yes,
big goal. And a lot of people would say that. You're at a marina bar or something. You're like, you know what I'm going to do one day? I'm like, I'm sure you are. They sold it. They're in the Bahamas right now, and they're living that life, which is amazing.
I like to go to some of the dockside bars, and you have occasionally an owner. But in some of the places, especially sand parts where you go, you have the crew. And you'll have one of these small yachts, which, I don't know, 125 feet, something like that. And they'll have a crew of, you know, 15, 16 people. And their whole job is to basically maintain the craft. So the owner flies in. That's where the owner stays on the island. And then those 14, 15, 16 people, whatever, take care of his guests, take care of all the maintenance, and basically then reposition the boat where it has to be for the owner next time. It's a pretty cool lifestyle, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
But I have no idea. I mean, you have to be in a nautical family or in a nautical situation to even be considered for a gig like that. And I've talked to them, you know, these boats will be, you know, in the millions of dollars, but annual maintenance on these boats is like $350,000, $400,000 by the time you, you know, deal with hull painting and fuel and berthing fees and everything else. I mean, any, you know, Lotto 649 winner could buy a boat, but the real cost is in maintaining it.
Yeah, and a good rule of thumb that I heard years ago, and it, you know, I've had our 38-footer, it's a 2001, It is not one of these yachts you're talking about, but it's not a small vessel. And it's proven to be pretty accurate that about 10% of the purchase price of your vessel, whatever size and year it is what you're going to spend every year in everything. Mm-hmm. So when you add up the docking fees, the fuel, the insurance, it sort of worked that way for us. And, you know, we bought our boat. It was $120,000. 11 years ago. If you're buying a $100 million boat and spending 10% a year.
Oh, $100 million? You'd be embarrassed to show up with a $100 million boat.
That's true.
I saw one this past week, and it's sort of a yacht, but it's more of a submarine. And this Italian firm, shipbuilding firm, they haven't built it yet, but they will spec it out for $2 billion. U.S. dollars, and it can do, I think, 12 knots underwater.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm only, you know, a billion and a half is sort of my hard ceiling
me
right
too.
Now. So
me
that's,
too. I can't justify anything more than that.
No. And maybe we'll pool our money, but I kind of want to own it myself, so we'll hold off on that plan for now.
My dream is to be able to, what I would do is I'd simply, I'd lease a boat. And, you know, when we win Lotto Max, we'll get a boat that sleeps 10, invite some couples with us. Oh, there's Christopher Cross playing in the background.
Right.
There's your yacht rock. We would just start in the Virgin Islands and make our way down to Grenada, you know, on a very leisurely sort of course.
Yeah. Well, you said you go to St. Bart's a bunch. You've been in the Caribbean a lot. Is that just proximity from
it
where
is.
We are, or is it you've traveled a lot of places and that's just the place you go
no,
back
I've,
to?
No, I've done sailing in Southeast Asia around Indonesia. I've done some sailing in, where else? The Eastern Mediterranean. And that's about it. Yeah, that's about it. I do like the Caribbean simply because of the water.
Yeah.
And if you go to a place like the Tobago Keys, I mean, it's really tough to beat that kind of beauty and that kind of snorkeling and that just chilling out on a boat with the water that's the color of, you know, very light gin. And you can see the sea turtles below. Oh, I've done Maldives, too. Which
it's a heck of a list.
It is a good list. I mean, I like being on the water. I just don't want to be in charge.
Fair enough. That's a good one. You know, we interviewed Ron McLean a couple days ago, and he's an avid sailor and a racer, but he doesn't captain on the races. You know, he could in better weather and stuff like that, but same thing. Like, he wants to be on the boat, likes to be on the boat, but doesn't want to be the one in control of all, because there's so much, especially in waters like that. It could be shallow. Every little area has their own idiosyncrasies that you'd want to be comfortable with.
There is a massive regatta, the Bucket Regatta, in St. Bart's every March, and it attracts some pretty heavy hitters. Some of the people that you see in the America's Cup will be there, you know, just to hang out. I mean, it's not an America's Cup level type sailing competition, but you get an awful lot of experienced, very rich sailors and very expensive boats sweeping around the island, and it's just such a cool thing to watch.
That's cool. So sailing obviously checks checks the box on the list for you. What about, you're in the Caribbean, fishing's a big thing. Are you into that at all?
I tried it a couple of times, but we ended up with nothing, so that was just money overboard. So
just washing lures.
Yeah, I wanted to see if I could get a, you know, a sailfish or a tuna or something like that, and it's just like, no, there was just nothing. So all I got on those particular rides was a sunburn.
Yeah, well, that's the way it is, right? If you get hooked early, you've probably hooked something, and otherwise it very quickly is not your scene.
Yeah, I was a big fisher when I was a kid with my uncle and my dad, and I still have my first fish. It was a big thing in our family that the first fish you catch gets stuffed, and it's up on the wall of my parents' place.
Oh, yeah?
56 years later.
Still there?
Still there.
Oh, that's
nice. It was a three-pound pickerel. My sister had a 3.5-pound northern pike.
That's about the size. I was about 11 years old when I caught one up north of Toronto, Muskoka areas. My dad had a cottage up there. And as an 11-year-old, I caught this pike. Yeah, probably 3 or 4 pounds. But it was a monster at the time. And so we've got it stuffed. It's on the wall. My son, who's now 8, every year he comments on how it looks smaller. Because when he was a kid, it was this monster with these huge teeth. Now he's like, you know, that's not that big. Why'd you stuff it?
Yeah, I know exactly the same thing. I'm going to see my parents in a couple of weeks. It's up on the wall in the basement, and I'll look at it and go, yeah, that. But I remember such a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, we took it to the guy in Winnipeg, and he explained how he's, you know, how do you want it posed, and, you know, with the mouth open, mouth closed, all that kind of stuff. So we got a bit of a thrash on it with his mouth open, and.
Do you want the driftwood in the back, something else? Yeah, you can really, they can, they're artists in a unique way. All right, well, you talked about Jimmy Buffett's house and the Le Select and Cheeseburger in Paradise. Let's talk about Jimmy a bit more because, you know, rest in peace, Bubba, but he was the voice and sound to so many people for so long.
5 o'clock somewhere.
Mm-hmm, 5:30 in Newfoundland. how do you think that okay, like, you know, he carved out this, we kind of created the niche in a sense.
Well, yeah, he did. And Jimmy Buffett is a really interesting character in the sense that he defined the chillax lifestyle as far as everything from Key West on down. And he wrote songs that talked about that kind of life, or at least captured that kind of attitude. And in the process, he gathered this giant fan base, which he called the Parrot Heads. And then he invested the money in many different things outside of music. He had there's a retirement community, the Margaritaville restaurants, and so on.
I didn't know there was I knew the restaurants. A marina called One Particular Harbor near Anna Maria Island where we go for vacation. Retirement community.
Yep, in Florida. Yeah, he did. And he did it. He, you know, was from what I understand, also very philanthropic when it came to the ocean and coral reefs and you know, all that sort of stuff, trying to raise awareness about climate change and various issues there. And he could do this largely because of the Parrot Head fan base. They would follow him everywhere. This is a guy without a lot of radio hits after 1980, but he continued to put out records. People continued to buy the records. People continued to go to the shows. Now, here's an interesting thing about Jimmy Buffett fans. Jimmy Buffett was one of the very few people that when he launched a tour, he could negotiate that he would get at least 105% of the box office gross. Now you're asking.
Yeah, hang on a second. I didn't do that great in math, but I know how percentages work. So go on.
So he would get an extra 5% above every dollar that people spent on tickets. And the reason he could negotiate that was because Parrot Heads were such huge drinkers. And the amount of beer and alcohol they consumed at a Jimmy Buffett show was so great that he could say, I want 5% of beverage sales. And he got it.
Wow.
One of the very few people to be able to do that.
You know, I'm glad I did. I love music. I like playing music, but I don't know what it is. I'm one of those, since a young age, I've been a grumpy old man at live shows. It's like, don't bump into me. That's too loud.
Sit down.
Yeah. You're ruining it for the rest of us. Get off my lawn. But there's a few concerts that I have gone to, a few that I really want. Paul McCartney was one that I had to make. It was my Beatles pilgrimage.
Yep.
And Jimmy Buffett was another. When he was here in Toronto, I went with my wife and a bunch of friends from the marina. We got all parrot-headed up and everything. And yeah, it was a good time. And I believe what you're saying there. I won't cite my exact sources, but there was a fair bit consumed.
He was that fan base. It was, is, I guess, extraordinarily rabid and loyal and free spending.
Yeah. So I know you're more in the rock and the new rock world. Did you ever cross paths or meet Jimmy?
No, I never had an opportunity because he was in his own world. I worked with a guy at one time who was if we go back to 2004, 2005, this guy had been on 65 cruises and had crossed the equator a dozen times on a cruise. And there's a term for those people. I can't remember what you call them.
Yeah, I know there's a line crossing ceremony, but there's a term.
Anyway, he was a huge parrot head, and it didn't matter where Jimmy Buffett was playing. If he had an opportunity to go see him on vacation, he would.
Yeah.
And you would ask him. It's like, what's the appeal? He says, I don't know. You know it when you're there.
Parrot heads and dead heads are sort of, there's a lot of overlap in that Venn diagram. Yeah. So you haven't met him, you don't know. So this is a speculation question, but you know, you've been in this world, you've interviewed a lot of artists. I've heard, and I'm assuming this is true, that Margaritaville, his most famous hit for the average Jimmy Buffett fan, he didn't particularly like that song himself. Now, whether that's you hear it all the time, you have to play it all the time, or whether it was one of those, I just slapped this song together and I didn't intend it to be huge. This happens, I think, with other artists too, right? Where something becomes a hit and that's what's driving the bus. Like it or not, you're going to play this every time. That's what the fans want.
It happens more than you realize simply because artists always want to grow. It's not what I did yesterday. It's what I'm doing now and what I want to do tomorrow. And if you get trapped into a loop playing your greatest hits, it can be soul-sucking for them because they are artists and they want to continue to evolve as artists. But sometimes you'll have a massive monster song or a series of monster songs if you're that lucky, and you will be trapped into playing them for the rest of your life regardless of how tired you get of them. And you know what? When we play them live, you better play it note for note and you better sound like you're enjoying what you're playing because that's what the people came to see.
That I am a big Michael Jackson fan, and the documentary This Is It, I was in Nairobi working when it came out, and we saw it 5 or 6 times, and I loved seeing that when he was talking to his musical director and everything. It's like, it has to sound like the record. The people heard it, they want to come, and they want to hear Michael Jackson play Smooth Criminal. They, a little flourish at the beginning or something for the showmanship, but the song is going to be the same beat, the same tempo. We're not changing it up. Even though you've played it 700 times this year, they're hearing it one time, and they've paid a lot of money.
And they think you're playing that song just for them.
Yep.
So you don't improvise. The vocal delivery had better be exactly what it is on the record because they're singing along with you. And if you don't sing what they're singing, well, then that's wrong. So, yeah, I understand the problem.
Yeah. So Jimmy had his whole world, and there was some spin-off. You get like Zach Brown Band, the country artist, and they did some duets, and then 5 O'Clock Somewhere with Alan Jackson. And there was a lot of people that were sort of in the Jimmy Buffett world, but he was his own entity, and probably won't see anyone just like him. It's not like a role that will be filled. There'll be a bunch of people doing it.
Yeah, he was around when this was all new and innovative. You can only be the first once.
Yeah.
And he really was that. if we have to go back and say, you know, ground zero for the Chillaxin yacht rock style, it's Jimmy Buffett. In my eyes, anyway. People, if you want to debate that, come on, we'll fight. But that's yeah. the way I perceive things, and everything falls in behind because Jimmy actually was a boater. He yep. was a sailor. He was the son of a sailor. So he has the bona fides that I think make him the king of that sort of thing.
Yeah. Now, way before Jimmy, there was nautical music and sea shanties and the Navy workers and all that kind of stuff. And they've been around for a while. And if you like, you know, East Coast and Celtic music like I do, and if you like Great Big Sea, they would, you know, they would do some of that stuff, put their spin on it. But then it had this resurgence a couple years ago with...
It lasted about 6 months.
Yeah, but it was a big 6 months.
It was. I think it was. There was a postman in England, maybe Scotland. I can't remember. And somehow, this was, I believe, during the early days of the pandemic, when people were looking for something escapist and uplifting. And this guy came along with a modern twist on a sea shanty, and it blew up virally. And I don't remember. I wrote about it.
Yeah, Wellerman.
Yes, thank you.
Yep.
And it, I guess from his Willy boots, right? It blew up, and there were a number of breathless articles written, mostly in the British press, about how sea shanties were the next big thing, and they were going to take us through this horrible lockdown period. Well, there were a couple of other songs that came out in that same sort of vein, but then it all kind of just... It petered out
yeah.
on a mainstream level. I mean, sea shanties are there. If you go to Ireland, if you go to Scotland, if you go to England and you're on the coast, and, you know, Isle of Wight, the Jersey Islands, you know, you'll find them there because that's part of the tradition. And it's really cool when you're in that environment. But once you take it out of that environment and you're in, you know, Des Moines, Iowa, for example, I mean, a sea shanty doesn't really mean much to you. I mean, you know, as a person from Manitoba, I hear a sea shanty and I think Popeye.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not quite the same. You're no. not you're not in that 4 feet of water singing a sea shanty.
No,
on
you're not.
Your canoe.
You're not. I'm not in my boots and I'm not in my raincoat and I'm not, you know, hauling lobster traps over the side of the boat.
Really? And yeah, it was probably around 6 months. It wasn't that long. It was more than a blip, but it
yeah.
wasn't the next genre that
this,
took
I think
over.
Wellerman actually, he charted rather highly, you know, top 20 in the UK.
Yeah.
Maybe even higher. Again, it came and it went, but when it was here for those short weeks, it was a big deal.
Yeah, it was fun. And they're purposefully catchy. They've got a beat. It's like, you know, it doesn't matter where in the world a song or musical style is from. You know, you go all the way back to early humans in Africa and making drums and pounding and mm-hmm. the rhythmic kind of thing. And that's what they're all about. It's just pounding rhythm and easy to sing and catchy. So you'd sing them on your ship like an army marching song.
Yeah. I was in Scotland in October to pick up a dog, our little bull terrier named Snug. And while we were there, we were in just outside of Dundee and went to a pub. And it was... pub night, you know, and people sitting around and yo-ho-hoing, and it was really cool. But the moment you get outside the club or the pub, it's just like, yeah, okay, that works inside those walls, not necessarily here at Starbucks.
Yeah, it's similar. You've been to a Great Big Sea show?
Yeah.
Yeah, same kind of thing where yeah. it's a
This is the greatest music ever!
Yeah, and then you listen to it the next day, and then, you know, you get yeah. in your car to drive to work. And it's
a
like,
it's a community thing.
Yeah.
You know, if you're surrounded by the right people in the right environment with the right libations, it's fantastic. But if you're in Toronto commuter traffic, as uplifting as this music might be, it's probably not going to help you much.
So here's one I'm going to throw at you. More on the technical side of things. So you have... you know, there's the broadcast quality stuff that you deal with in the studio, but at home, like, you're a music fan. You listen to music. You've got a nice stereo with good speakers.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a lot of stuff here at the Toronto Boat Show and any boat show for sale, like, and a lot of these little Bluetooth speakers are for sale. How does speakers, like, what do you want? If you want a rich and a good sound, what are you looking for in a speaker? Because you can't just...
No, the problem with the Bluetooth speakers that nobody ever talks about is that they deliver music in mono. You need two sound sources for there to be a stereo image. Now, that doesn't always work because of where you have to place the speakers. A Bluetooth is often the best thing that you can do when you have, for example, an open deck and there really is no proper way to orient yourself so that you are sitting in a proper stereo soundstage situation. So, okay, mono is good. As long as these speakers are have sufficient power, so you can have them as loud as you want over the water, over the wind, over the engine, over the people who are getting drunk on your boat. And battery power is another big issue. And then is it waterproof or not? I have a Sonos, which is at home. And it actually, how do I describe it? It looks like a giant, giant commuter coffee mug with a handle. And it weighs maybe 12 pounds, and it's completely waterproof. And I can take that and put it out in the rain, or I could, you know, it could fall overboard, and I could still fish it out, and it would still work. And it sounds great. If I'm going to make a recommendation, now that I'm thinking of it, try, and I can't remember the model designation, but it's the portable Sonos outdoor speaker.
Okay. Yeah, because there are some, you know, you want something waterproof, you want something you just plop down on a picnic table, whatever, you're not going to get the full setup, but you're... Don't expect that rich surround sound stereo.
You can't. You can't. Unless you have proper... it doesn't really work on a boat. It would work on the interior, maybe. But for out on the deck, no. It's just get the biggest, loudest, most waterproof speaker that you can possibly get and just enjoy it.
Yeah. This isn't the happy side of boating, but shipwrecks. Edmund Fitzgerald being one. Mm-hmm. That's another, you know, it's associated with boating. I was out salmon fishing on my boat, and we were in the middle of Lake Ontario, and my friend said, hey, could you play Edmund Fitzgerald? And I said, yeah, that's super good luck, I think, to play out here, too.
But you're on Ontario, not Superior. It's fine.
That's true.
My experience with Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald as a radio person is that that was the song that you pulled out when you needed to go to the bathroom. It was anything that was over 6 minutes and 30 seconds long would be considered a bathroom song. Now, this is back in the days when you actually played records and CDs, and if you weren't back in the studio by the time the song ended, well, then you had dead air, which you could never possibly have. So you had a selection of songs that you would reach into and pull out and put on during those perilous times.
So if you had some bad oysters, it's the extended version of Inagata De Vita.
You know, exactly. You know, you don't have that problem anymore because radio stations, almost every single radio station in the world is based on a hard drive playback system, so there really doesn't need to be anybody in the studio at all. But back in the days of CDs and records, yeah, Edmund Fitzgerald saved me more than once.
I like it. So you've been, you know, covering music, playing music for a few decades now. Mm-hmm. Really high level. What has changed and what has stayed the same in just sort of the music that you've been playing? Not all music worldwide.
The music has become so fragmented that there is no center to music anymore. None of us are on the same page. Outside of maybe Taylor Swift, outside of maybe Beyonce, everybody is off doing their own thing. And the traditional gatekeepers, the institutions and organizations that used to keep people in a certain narrow range of music, have lost the power. That would be radio stations, music magazines, video channels, record labels, and record stores. Now we all have our smartphones and we're able to listen to any song ever recorded with a couple of pokes in our phone, and it costs us next to nothing, if not nothing entirely. So the value that a lot of people ascribe to music is a lot less than it used to be, because in the days of purchasing pieces of plastic, you were making a financial investment in this music. And you were going to listen to that CD or that album until you liked every single song, because if you didn't, well, then it was a financial failure. You had made a mistake, and you never wanted to make that mistake. And also in the era of albums, you know, if you're listening to a song or listening to a side of an album and, you know, track three, let's say, is something that you didn't really want to listen to, well, fine, you just let it play through until you get to four. You'd be too lazy to get up and move the record. So in that way, or move the Tonar. So in that way, you were repeatedly exposed to a piece of music unintentionally. And after a while, what may have happened is that you began to appreciate that song because it took multiple listenings against your will before the penny dropped. Now we have the skip button. Streaming has changed the way music is constructed. Shorter intros, choruses up front, lots of hooks in that first 30 seconds because, I don't know if a lot of people know this, but nobody gets paid for a stream unless you listen to the first 31 seconds of a song.
Oh.
So that in itself is corrupting and changing the way composers and producers look at songs. So, you know, short intros and hooks up front and the choruses up front and all that sort of stuff. Let's go back to, let's say, U2 and the Joshua Tree album. Side one, track one is Where the Streets Have No Name. And it starts with this synthesizer drone that comes up out of the silence, evoking the cinematic sort of feel about maybe the sunrise or sunset over the desert. I don't know. It goes on and on and on. There's a couple of key changes. Then the Edge comes in, starts playing this arpeggio on his guitar. That goes on for a little while longer than Andy. And then Larry Adam come in with the bass and drums, and that builds and builds and builds. And finally, Bono starts singing about 2 minutes into the song. Well, that would not work today because people would go after 5 or 10 seconds. What is this crap? Skip.
Yeah.
So I have some real concerns about where music is going simply because people are gaming the technology. People's attention spans are short. There are about 110, 120 million songs available on Spotify. Somewhere around 45 million of those songs have never been streamed once. There's too much music. 103,000 songs are being uploaded every day on average.
103,000?
103,000 every day.
Jeez.
Yeah. So there's no way that anybody can keep up. There's no way that anybody knows what's going on. And if you don't, you have all these small micro scenes that people discover, mess around with for a bit, and then go off and do something else. So they come to get self-organizing, self-destructing, and it's happening on and on and on. So there's no way for everybody to have this consensus about, hey, this is good. This is what we all need to be listening to. This is what we all need to get into. There's very, very little of that today compared to where we were 25 years ago.
Yeah, and so then you were talking about with Jimmy Buffett and the community, really, that his music and the brand and the atmosphere sort of fostered, that doesn't happen because you dip in somewhere, you do a little bit, but then you move on. So you're not going to invest your time and money.
And I guarantee you that there are several thousand Jimmy Buffett clones out there that we've never heard of. But again, you can only be first. And then when things fragment and separate and stratify, this is what you end up with.
Yeah. And, you know, there are positives to it as well, that the gatekeepers, you know, aren't keeping people out, so you can put your stuff out there, mm-hmm. and there are those options, and you see those stories. Who was it? Shawn Mendes that was Vine videos, and that was his breakout, and now he's doing arena tours.
Yeah, what happened to Vine?
Yeah,
you
right?
Know, that's all gone. Yeah.
But then it's everywhere.
You know, Shawn Mendes, Justin Bieber, some of these people who came out through social media, that was of an era. That whole thing is it's not happening the way it used to. We hear about some artists who have one song that may break out virally as a result of social media, and then they're gone. They have no experience of playing live. They don't have enough material to play a set. And they only have one good song that is there for that particular moment. So the record labels right now have completely forgotten how to discover and break and cultivate new music. And this is creating a problem because about 75% of all the music that's being streamed is music that's more than two years old. So only about 25% of the music that people are listening to is current. And if that's the problem, where are your classic hits going to come from down the road? You're not making them. Everybody is just gorging on all the old stuff that was already there. And there's a lot of it there. But where, you know, eventually you're going to wear that out. And where's the new stuff coming from? There's a lot. I mean, that's a podcast series on its own.
Yeah, no kidding. And it gives on the bright side, though, having this, you know, you can just drop one song on YouTube or something like that means you can get things like lonely islands. I'm on a boat without having to buy an album. I don't want to listen to an album worth of that, but one song, that was a lot of fun.
That's it. But what about the rest of Lonely Island's career?
Yeah, true.
That's the issue, right? You're old enough to remember how big used to be, you know, filling stadiums. Very few people can do that these days.
My first concert was U2 at Sky Dome when it was still called Sky Dome. Yeah. And it was their, what was that tour? Zuropa or whatever.
Yeah, okay.
One of them. But I didn't go to many concerts, but it was early 90s, and it was a scene, man. Like, you go into where the Jays played, and there's this huge stage, and they were just four humans, but larger than life, and this mat, and they're doing that around the world.
Yeah, we've done a very terrible job of creating stadium-level bands since 2000. A lot of that has to do with technology. The internet has completely upended things, and the industry hasn't figured out how to deal with the internet yet. And you know, let's count the number of brand new acts that have emerged since 2000 who are capable of filling a stadium. Taylor Swift is one. Beyonce is another. We can probably, you know, put Arcade Fire in there. Probably put, you might be able to fudge numbers a little bit and put Coldplay in there, but they actually emerged in 1997 and 1998, so they don't count. It's interesting. It really is interesting, and I think that we are heading for some kind of reckoning when it comes to new music, simply because the industry, the people that are in charge of marketing and distributing this stuff, have gotten lazy, and people are not buying what they're selling as much anymore.
All right. Well, before we go, two things I want to do. One, The Science of Song, How and Why We Make Music, your book here. So you've graciously signed a couple copies. We're going to give them away. Tell me a bit about that, because that's something else I'm fascinated with. That's why we had Neil deGrasse Tyson on the episode when I got to New York, because I want to talk about the science of boating. People don't think of these aspects of it. You just sit back and press play.
Did he talk about Archimedes and displacement principles?
He did.
Of course he did.
He told me Archimedes would be disappointed in me because I couldn't explain it.
Yeah. He probably would. Eureka!
Yeah.
Yeah. Probably. A number of years ago, maybe 10, no, longer now, I was approached by somebody to help create a traveling museum exhibit that would go to science centers and technology exhibits called The Science of Rock and Roll. And I thought, well, this is really kind of cool. I've always really been interested in the science behind, well, the intersection of science and music, the intersection of music and technology. So we did this exhibit, and it was at the Ontario Science Center. It was in Kansas City and Boston and Detroit and Cleveland and a bunch of other places. It's needs a refurbish, so it's not anywhere now. And I was the, I don't even know what my title was, but I wrote the museum exhibit.
Right, a curator or something like that.
Sort of. I would tell the curators what out to go out and get. And then when there was a display, I would tell the museum writers what needed to be written in the display in the captions for
something. Puppet master,
something like that. Anyway, after that, I had all this information, and Kids Can Press said, "Well, why don't you put this into a book for children? And they can explain. You could explain the science of music to, you know, 8 to 14 year olds." So that's what I did.
Cool. So we don't need the full spoiler alert. Give me one or two little cool tidbits that are in there, because I bought one for my son, and I'm probably more excited to read it than he is. But
okay, why does an acoustic guitar have a hole in it?
Oh, I mean, that's, I'm guessing that's where the sound,
it's called Heimholtz,
but like the placement, I'm sure matters, and the size. And
it has to do something called Heimholtz frequencies.
Heimholtz.
Yes, I mean it's all in there.
Mm.
Did you know that a CD is played with a laser? You knew that.
Yeah.
But did you know that the CD tracks from the inside out?
No.
An album, a vinyl album, would be from the outside in.
Right.
CDs are from the inside out.
Oh.
Did you know that on an album that's one single long spiral groove and it runs about 1,500 feet? See? Stuff like that.
That's cool.
Oh, yeah. It's goofy stuff. It's fun.
Yeah. Speaking of albums, which is neither here nor there, but only because I have you in front of a microphone and I'm going to forget, I think there was an ongoing history of new music, one where there's sort of interesting stuff. And was it Jack White of the White Stripes that did some weird stuff with vinyl where you could play, they tried to do one going backwards or something weird.
Jack White owns his own record pressing plant in Detroit, and he's got one in Nashville too. And when you have your own plant, you can do all kinds of weird things with the pressing plates. And you know, he had double grooved records, which meant that you could put your put the stylus down, and depending on which groove it caught, it would play one or the other of the programming on that side. Monty Python was the first to do that. And they did that because they wanted to really mess with people's heads. You put on side one, and you put it down the first time, and you hear side one go through. Friend come over and says, oh, you got to hear this. It's really funny. And you put the needle down on side one, and it's completely different.
No, that's great.
So that's there's a double groove records. He had records that had multiple layers to them, and that would be things on the inside that had, oil, for example. So when it played, the oil would spin around. There was other ones that had 3D effects. If you look down at from the top, as the record spun, you would see like a 3D thing happen. Alice in Chains has got a 30th anniversary of their Jar of Flies album coming out in March, and the vinyl version has actual flies embedded in the vinyl. There was another group called Slightly Stupid that experimented with making a record out of hash resin. So once it wore out, you smoked it. there's a company in the UK that will take your loved one's cremated ashes, press it into a record, and you could listen to that for the rest of your... Oh, yeah. Man, there's all kinds of stuff that you can do this way.
Okay, well, before I let you go, I'm going to put you on the spot. You are being assigned, like someone, one of your friends with a boat says, all right, we're going to go do a cruise somewhere. You're in charge of the music. We don't need all of them. Give me a few of your go-to. What would be in the boating playlist for Alan Cross?
Well, maritime law says you have to have Bob Marley's Legends. There is no way around it. That is international maritime law.
you hear that, kids?
Yeah.
Go out and buy it. Make sure you buy it, though. Don't just download
it. Don't just download it. Yeah, you need that. What else would I put in there? What has a nautical theme? Wow. You know what? I would probably default to a bunch of yacht rock stuff.
It works when you're out there.
Well, it does, and I would be very careful. It would be Steely Dan. It would be Pablo Cruz. Never heard of Pablo Cruz?
I'll be searching after.
Yeah, Love Will Find a Way. Try that. That Love Will Find a Way by Pablo Cruz to me is the ultimate yacht rock song beyond Christopher Cross and Sailing. I mean, I will drown myself. I will throw myself overboard with a cinder block tied to my ankle if somebody plays Sailing and I'm on a boat someplace. I really will.
So if you're keeping score at home, we're going to mark Alan down as undecided on the song Sailing.
Yes. I think that's what I did. It has to be mid-tempo stuff. You don't want stuff that's going to make you sleepy unless it's sunset.
Right.
Which you want to set the mood. But for the rest of the day, you just want well-produced stuff. And the reason you want well-produced stuff, I mean, you can't have, you know, Dead Kennedys, you know, Holiday in Cambodia playing. It just doesn't really work. Well, I guess it depends on what body of water you're on, what kind of boat you're on, what kind of people you're with. That's
a good point. I've been out. Oh, go ahead.
I would throw Kind of Blue, Miles Davis.
Ah.
I would put that on there. And I would probably also, Air Supply is another band I'd dive off the boat to avoid. Carlos Santana. Early Carlos Santana.
Okay. It all fits. But you're right, though. It does change. It depends on the boat. Depends on the body of water. It's very... And the conditions you're in. So I've been out on smaller boats doing like a TV shoot, and then the weather has changed, and you're slamming through waves, and so safe, sure, but like the sea's a little angry, and for some reason the harder rock seems to work.
It works. I agree. If it's a perfect storm and you're George Clooney and you're going up that rogue wave, well, I don't think you want to have One Love by Bob Marley playing because it's just not going to work.
No. When I took this that starter boat from Toronto to Montreal to Manhattan, there was... long stretches I was by myself. So from Albany to New York City, it's 140 nautical miles, about 5-hour run. And I was by myself. And for part of it, it was that kind of calm music I need. Not calm, but you know, mid-tempo, and then, you know, the waves kicked up a little bit and it clouded over, and then I was into some more alt rock, and I was going back to my 90s. It was Pearl Jam and Nirvana and stuff like that, which fit.
Let me ask you a question. If you had a choice of a brand new boat, and let's be realistic.
Okay.
In other words, don't tell me that you want a 150-foot yacht. What boat would you choose? What would you want to add to your armada?
Okay, good question. And my first caveat to this, because I get asked this all the time by people as I'm traveling around, I say to everyone that what type of boat is a similar question to what type of shoe. It all depends on what you want to do with it. So you're asking personally, of course, but so I'd say to someone, like, you know, if you want to walk on the beach, your footwear is going to be different than you want to climb a mountain. So that's step one. So what I would want to do, I am a convert. I used to, you know, a lot of people didn't like pontoons. Mm-hmm. I have grown to love them because I've been on so many. You know, you can get, I've been on one that had twin 400
on a pontoon bar, boat?
On a pontoon. There is like zero drag to them either. Insane. Yeah, so you only got a couple inches of that pontoon in the water, which doesn't take much to move anyway, and you can get ridiculous. There's one over here. It's got, I think, 450 horsepower on it on a pontoon boat. Not that I want the go-fast pontoon.
Well, I was going to say, how much of a hurry do you... I mean, that's not exactly a drug smuggler boat.
No.
So why would you need... 400 horsepower in the back of one of those things.
To show off to your neighbor.
Oh, yeah,
like,
right,
hey, check this out.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I've been trying to talk my dad, and he's got a place up north on the water. I was trying to get him to get a pontoon because that works for there. I personally really like the center consoles. You can get some bigger ones because I spend a lot of time in Florida and a lot of time in the Great Lakes. So that would work. And then, so we have a 2001... Sea Ray 380 Sundancer. So a 38-foot powerboat. It's got, I don't know, two bedrooms on it. We live, it's our floating cottage, but we'll take it across to New York. We're, somewhere between passively and actively looking for something new. And I am someone that, like, I am all in on the boating life. I, you know, nothing against people that have cottages, but I don't know anything about property maintenance. Mm-hmm. So I'd rather have the floating thing. So... yeah, something like that. So if I had somewhere on the water, I'd get a pontoon. Even if I had like a Florida house or a Muskoka place, I'd get a pontoon. Maybe not 400 horsepower. To trailer around, I like the center consoles because you can fish off them, you can cruise off them. I think that's where I'd go.
Okay.
I wouldn't go for, you know, they've got these wakeboard and wake surf boats. That's a whole other... Boating is a lot like music, actually, that there are... sort of genres and subgenres that, and they can be really intense. So, like, a rock fan might hate pop, like Taylor Swift.
Got it.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And even though you might say, oh, they're all music, they're like, no, that's garbage, or I don't like this. So, same. Like, I have friends that are sailors that a powered vessel is a stink pot and I hate it. And then I have powerboat friends that are like, I wouldn't do a sailboat. And yeah, then tow sports, you get like the slalom crowd that want the small waves and hate the big waves of the wake surfers. And then the wake surfers that want all the bells and whistles and the big speakers. It's
and the drug dealers that want the cigarette boats.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Not that we know any of those people.
No, not at all. A what? A droog, you said? I've never heard of these things. Perfect. Well, I really appreciate your time. Thanks for coming down to join us here at the Toronto International Boat Show for talking boat stuff. We talked boat stuff, music, and all kinds of stuff in between.
It's funny. I knew more about boats than I realized.
Right? This is perfect. Because when we set it up, you're like, well, I'm not that much of a boater. And then, oh, my, yeah, you are. We could have gone even longer.
We could have, because now I'm talking about my friend Yeats and his antique boat from 1934.
Ooh, yeah. Those are nice, too.
Yeah,
see,
yeah.
You know what? Actually, now I got to update my answer. Friend of mine's all in that vintage boat world. Maybe not wood, because that's a lot of maintenance.
Yes.
They're beautiful.
Yes.
And the people that love the maintenance, it's like therapeutic for them. Right?
And I would just run it into a dock.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I would do.
I'd go vintage fiberglass, like with the wings. Like,
okay.
Looks like a, you know, 1950s Bel Air. There's one over back here. It's just stunning. Perfect. Okay, well, we can talk more about boats. Next time we'll record it, we'll be out on the water somewhere.
Deal. Okay.
All right. Thank you, Alan Cross, for joining us. Enjoy everything, and we'll find you. So, you know what? Actually, people that want to find you, how do we do it? Ongoing History, New Music,
yeah,
your website?
At Alan Cross on X. I have my two podcasts, The Ongoing History of New Music and Uncharted Crime and Mayhem in the Music Industry. And just email me if you want to talk about something, alan@alancross.ca.
Perfect. Well, we'll see you on the water, and until then, we'll hear you on the airwaves. Thanks, buddy.